You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, it's Ben Mathis here with just a quick favor to ask. We love having great advertisers support the show, but in order to continue doing that, we need your help. So please go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that'll help us get to know you a little better. That way we can show advertisers just how enthusiastic our audience is about Kick-Ass News and keep the show free for listeners like you. Even if you've taken our podcast listener survey before, the current one is new and different, and it's really important that we have lots of listener feedback, so I'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to fill out this new one. Plus, as a thank you, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey.com/kick, podsurvey.com/kick. Also, if you haven't already, please subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes. Even if you usually listen to the show on some other app like SoundCloud or Spotify, the most important thing for any podcast like ours is our iTunes rating, which is entirely dependent on our listeners subscribing on iTunes. So just go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, look up Kick-Ass News, and click subscribe. It's that simple. And if you've already subscribed on iTunes, consider taking a moment to rate and review Kick-Ass News while you're there. Thanks for listening and continuing to support the show. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. If you're like me, at some point in high school, you were assigned to read the great American classic Catcher in the Rye and introduced to the author J.D. Salinger's rebellious alter ego, Holden Caulfield. The only novel ever published by Salinger, Catcher in the Rye captured a restlessness and sense of alienation that resonated with young people in 1951 and continues to do so today, earning its place among the most venerated works in American literature. It's ironic for an author who held literary critics and the literary industry in general in disregard, if not outright contempt, deliberately shunning fans and virtually all publicity, and living most of his adult life in seclusion on a 90-acre farm in New Hampshire. As a result of this, one of the great authors of the 20th century remains in many ways a mystery to us. But a new film called Rebel in the Rye seeks to fill in some of the gaps, exploring the young J.D. Salinger's coming of age as a man and as a writer, the real-life events that inspired him to create Catcher in the Rye, and the difficult relationships he had with his mentors, his publishers, and the women in his life. The movie stars Nicholas Hoult as the famous author, with a stellar supporting cast that includes Zoe Deutsch, Kevin Spacey, Sarah Paulson, Brian D'Arcy James, Hope Davis, and Victor Garber. Rebel in the Rye is the first-time directing effort of actor, writer, producer, and now director Danny Strong, who you know from his recurring roles on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Gilmore Girls, as well as Mad Men, Justified, and Billions. He's also the co-creator of the hit television series Empire and the Emmy Award-winning screenwriter behind the HBO films Game Change and Recount, as well as The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1 and 2, and Lee Daniels' The Butler. Today, Danny joins me on the show to discuss the complicated life of J.D. Salinger and the challenges of portraying a man who spent so much of his life out of the public spotlight. We'll talk about the debutante who dumped Salinger for a much older Charlie Chaplin, how Salinger struggled with PTSD after World War II, why he shunned public attention, and whether he really deserved his reputation as a recluse. Danny will reveal how a young video store clerk named Quentin Tarantino stoked his early love of film, and the nickname Tarantino bestowed on Danny when he was just a kid. Danny will share some of his early challenges as an actor, how screenwriting kept him sane in between roles, and why he wouldn't want to direct a movie of Catcher in the Rye. Plus, we'll talk about our mutual love of the Broadway show Guys and Dolls, which he's now adapting for the big screen, and Danny wishes that someone would call him a bum. Coming up with Danny Strong in just a moment. Danny Strong is an award-winning quadruple threat actor, writer, producer, and director. You know his face from such TV series and films such as Pleasantville, Seabiscuit, Seinfeld, Nip Tuck, Third Rock from the Sun, Mad Men, Justified, and Billions. But he's best recognized for his 5 seasons on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and his 4 seasons on Gilmore Girls. After Gilmore Girls, Danny added writer to his list of credits, penning the scripts for the HBO films Recount, which earned him an Emmy nomination, and Game Change, which earned him 2 Emmy Awards. On the big screen, he co-wrote The Hunger Games Part 1 and 2 and Lee Daniels' The Butler. He also works with Lee Daniels as co-creator and writer of the hit TV series Empire. As if that's not enough, now he's directed his first film. It's a biopic of writer J.D. Salinger called Rebel in the Rye, which opens in theaters this September 8th. Danny, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that introduction. That was exciting to hear. I was like, wow, that sounds cool.
Yeah, you've had quite a career so far.
Yeah, it's been
and you're still a young guy.
Yeah, I'm waiting for them to kick me out any day now, maybe after this interview.
Well, I was reading your IMDb before you came in, and it said that you grew up in Manhattan Beach. And I was sort of amused that on IMDb, they describe Manhattan Beach as a little borough south of Los Angeles.
This lovely little borough yeah. of Manhattan Beach. Well, the Manhattan Beach I grew up
for some
in
reason.
Was so different than what it is now.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was this very sleepy middle class to lower middle class beach town.
Yeah.
And now it's very, very wealthy. And it was it's sort of the polar opposite of my childhood.
Yeah. Were you a surfer?
No, I was a volleyball player, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I'm not very tall, so they tell me. And I was, I believe, the shortest starter in the history of Maricosta High School volleyball team, which is my claim to fame.
And how did you guys do?
Oh, Maricosta High School was one of the leading volleyball high schools in the country. In Manhattan Beach is a volleyball town. I would say volleyball is to Manhattan Beach as basketball is to Indiana. I mean, it really yeah. is a big deal there. And the Manhattan Open is the Wimbledon of pro beach volleyball as it takes place there. And we have a lot of Olympians and pro beach players come out of Manhattan Beach, which I was neither yeah. an Olympian nor a pro beach player.
Well, you had acting to fall back on.
There you
I guess.
Go. Yeah.
I was interested to read that I guess you used to rent videos from video archives down there. And you befriended the video clerk who was a young Quentin Tarantino. He
yes.
would recommend movies to you. What kind of movies did he turn you on to when
well,
you were a kid?
It was pretty wild. I was a movie buff by the age of 10. And there was this avant-garde video store. And my mom knew I was into interesting movies. So she started taking me to this avant-garde video store. And I befriended the clerk who was a young Quentin Tarantino in his mid-20s, I guess. And I spent so much time with him that they called me Little Quentin. And they'd say, Quentin, Little Quentin's here. And then I'd show up and I'd sit there and talk to him for an hour at a time. And I'd go in 3-4 times a week. And I a lot of the films were a lot of genre stuff, which is not yeah. surprising. I remember there was this movie called Fear City that he said I had to see. You got to see this movie, okay? It's Fear City, all right? And I remember him recommending You're the Dragon, which was a movie yeah. that came out in the theater, and I was only 11, and it was rated R, and I kept sneaking into it, and I kept getting thrown out. So I got thrown out 3 times. And he was like, you got to stick to it, man. You got to see the movie. So my mom eventually took me because I got thrown. I was wasting too much money.
Do you ever run into him nowadays?
Yeah.
Does he still call you Little Quentin?
You know, he loves telling people the story. We actually, at the Golden Globes, when he won the Golden Globe for Django, I won the Golden Globe for Game Change. And so we were both at this after party holding our Golden Globes, and he was telling the entire room the story. He's just like, you don't get it, okay? This is little Quentin, all right?
And like it was mini-me.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Now, I wondered, when you decided that you were going to direct your first movie, did you ask him for any advice?
I didn't. I did tell him I was going to be directing a film, and he was so excited. Mm-hmm. First thing he said to me was, it's about time.
Now, when you were a kid and you were being exposed to all these movies, did you have a particular movie that was formative for you or inspirational?
Yeah, I was – I didn't watch kid movies when I was a kid. You know, I remember All That Jazz was one of my favorite movies when I was a
Bob
kid.
Oh, Bob Fosse.
Yeah, that's very strange, right? And
for,
I loved,
for a 10-year-old or teenage boy.
I think even younger, right? And Apocalypse Now and The Godfather.
Yeah.
And those were the movies I loved as a kid. I remember seeing The Third Man when I was 11, and I just loved it. And all these movies are still some of my favorites.
Yeah. Now, did you want to get into the business from an early age? And
yes.
What area interested you as a kid?
I wanted to be an actor since I think I was five, six years old. Yeah. And I would do impressions and accents and stuff. And I was when I was eight, I started writing letters to agents.
Really?
And agencies. Yeah, not even the specific agent, because I don't know what I'm doing, right?
Just addressed to CAA? CAA.
I did. I sent letters William Morris.
Did you think he was a real person?
I didn't know. It's a very good question.
Dear Mr. Morris.
Dear Mr. Morris. No, I remember sending letters to William Morris saying I wanted to be an actor and putting some pictures in the letters and waiting every day for a response. And I'd come home and, is this the day that William Morris is going to write me back? And Harry Gold, who his daughter Tracy and Missy Gold were these big TV stars at the time, and he was famous as their father agents. And I sent him letters, and no one ever responded.
No one ever responded?
No one ever responded.
So how did you get your first agent then?
I got my first agent when I think I was 14 or 15 through a friend at my high school. Gave my picture to an agent who wanted to meet with me. And so then the agent signed me, but I actually – and I went on a few auditions, but I was really more interested in doing high school theater and volleyball than really – I mean, I wanted to be on TV and do these commercials, but I would go on some auditions, and it wouldn't go anywhere. And so I didn't really start to audition more seriously till I was about 18, 19.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a theater major in college at USC. So I was at USC studying theater, also auditioning at the same time. And I never worked theater then, too. I mean, that was 4 years of auditioning where I didn't book anything.
Yeah, that's the one thing, aside from zero acting talent, that's dissuaded me from ever wanting to be an actor, is just having to constantly go in and try your hardest and get beat up and rejected over and over again. I mean, it's kind of soul-crushing, I imagine.
It chips
away at you.
How do you
get past that?
I don't know if you do.
Oh, really?
I mean, it sort of chips away at you, even though if you're you try to put up, I don't know if a veneer is the right word, but you just try and suck it up and keep going and keep going. But it is very, very disappointing. And that's actually why I started writing, was to get my mind off my auditions. And I started just writing, and it was almost therapeutic for me that no matter what happened with the audition, well, I'm going to go home and work on my script. To hell with them. I'm writing these days anyways. So that was sort of the beginning of that.
Yeah, when you're working a series, you do that for 4 years, and then it goes in waves. Then you may not have something big for, you know, a few years. Then you catch another wave. Was it sort of an antidote for that, something to keep you occupied and keep you from being depressed maybe even in those in-between periods?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And in my case, I was on Buffy and Gilmore Girls. I was a recurring character.
Right.
So I never had this job security. I never knew if I was going to be on another episode. So every episode could have been my last episode of those shows. And on Buffy, on season 6 of Buffy, I had a 10-episode contract. That's the only time in my career I ever had a contract like that as an actor. So even when I was on those shows, I was still pounding the pavement as hard as I could, trying to get other work, trying to make my rent, trying to qualify for health insurance as an actor, which I did every year. And to this day, I still don't know how. It was so scrappy, a combination of TV shows and commercials and voiceovers. And I would do one movie a year, and it was always really bad, but I was happy to book the movie. And it was just a really pounding the pavement existence for a decade.
Now, when you shifted gears after your stint on Buffy and the Gilmore Girls, did you find that it was hard to get the town to take you seriously as a writer at first?
Mm. No, I didn't, because
really,
as a writer, it's what matters as a writer is what is on the page.
Right.
So it doesn't matter who you are. And maybe someone might have a bias about reading a script if they know you're an actor. But at the end of the day, there's an actual proof of what you can and cannot do, and it's on that script. And once someone gets a few pages into a script, it really doesn't matter whose name's on it. Either they like it or they don't like it. And most scripts are pretty tough to read, to be honest with you. It's not easy to write a script. And so the writing just spoke for itself. And really savvy development people in the business know that when actors can write, they make terrific writers. So that's a thing that people know that's a pathway to becoming a writer is having been an actor.
Are you still interested in doing acting as well, or is this kind of where your passion is right now?
Well, when when my writing career finally took off after 6-7 years of doing that and not succeeding. There's a lot of not succeeding in this profession. I quit acting for 2 years, and it was the happiest 2 years of my life. It was amazing not having that hang over me for the first time in 15 years.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if I was ever going to act again, but I had this manager, David Sweeney, who had been with me for many years as an actor, and he didn't want me to stop. So he just kept calling me every few months saying, do you want to start up again? And I kept saying no, but I would be nice about it. And then finally he called me, said, I have an audition for you for Mad Men, which was the hottest show of the time and my favorite show, maybe one of my favorite shows of all time.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay, I'll go in on that audition. And then I got the part.
Yeah.
And so from there – and I did several episodes. It was an amazing experience.
You were like an ad agent who kind of went Hollywood,
didn't
cut it on Madison Avenue, and then you went to Hollywood.
And then
being a Hollywood producer was way easier.
Yeah. And I punched Roger Sterling in the balls, which is maybe one of my career highlights. So I, from there, I decided and have sort of kept to it, which is if something really cool comes along, it's usually a combination of a terrific show and a really cool part and something that's not too time-consuming, then I do it. And it's been – I've been pretty fortunate where it's been about once a year I end up on some terrific show and I have a wonderful time, and that's what I've been doing. You know, last season I did Billions, and I'll be back on Billions this season, and it's literally – the perfect acting job for me. It's a terrific part on a terrific show, and it's fun.
Yeah, it's a fantastic show. Now, before we started here, I heard you talking about Mark Halperin. Your first writing effort was Recount for HBO, which was widely acclaimed and, like I said, nominated for an Emmy. And then you followed it up with Game Change for HBO, which won you 2 Emmys, which was based on the Mark Halperin, John Heilman bestseller about the 2008 election. I've had them both on the show before. What are those two guys like to work with?
Oh, I love those guys. I mean, they've become really close friends of mine.
Really?
And I'm very fond of them. And, you know, they're two of the smartest political reporters in the country.
Yeah.
So they're fascinating. They're fascinating to talk to and hang out with, and they're completely different guys. They couldn't be more different. And I usually hang out with one or the other. I don't go out with them as a tandem. And they have wonderful wives and very dear friends of mine. And they're both very brilliant. And I usually just love to hear them talk about politics and just listen.
Are they insufferable now that they have their own show on Showtime?
No.
They hasn't gone to their heads?
No, not at all. I mean, it's in some ways it's made them cooler. I find some people success, they become, I don't want to say down to earth, but it relaxes them. And some people success turns them, it doesn't turn them into horrible people. They were probably just horrible people to begin with.
Yeah.
And the success just makes them feel comfortable being that way.
Yeah.
More often than not, I've found people, it's the opposite, where success kind of mellows them a little bit in a way where it makes them, you know, more fun to be around.
Well, one person who didn't get mellowed by success was J.D. Salinger.
Well, it was difficult for him, yeah.
Your directorial debut film is called Rebel in the Rye, and it got fantastic buzz after it premiered at Sundance this year. It is a biopic of J.D. Salinger that goes into his younger years and his writing of Catcher in the Rye and then struggling to deal with the success and fame that followed that book. if you're like me, I'm guessing that you probably read Catcher when you were in high school, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like everyone else, I read it when I was 14, a freshman in high school. Mm-hmm. Very, very influential on me, as it is for so many people, where I think it's the first time that many people read a book that reflects their own lives and their own mm-hmm. point of view so profoundly. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's the first time that they just experience themselves in art. Mm-hmm. And it really, I think, has a deep impact. I reread it, obviously, when I was writing the script, and I was pleasantly surprised at how much I loved it at this age. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just a gangbusters of a book. It was so funny and entertaining and cool and sad. And it was one of those things where time did not sour it. It held up and was so much fun to read.
Did you relate to Holden Caulfield?
I understood why I related to him in high school.
Yeah. Were you a smart ass?
Yeah, I was a total smart ass. Yeah. I mean, so much of Cookie Lion is my 12-year-old junior high smart ass. So when I'm writing Cookie Lion lines, it's a lot of it is I'm just channeling like this, you know, the young smart ass I was in high school and junior high.
Yeah. Did you walk around Manhattan Beach in a red hunter's cap?
Yeah, yes, I did. I'm wearing one right now for those who can't see. It's kind of sad, but hey, you just got to do what you got to do.
Well, there's a reason I think that you named it Rebel in the Rye. J.D. Salinger seems to constantly have had a chip on his shoulder, even from a young age. Why do you think that was?
That's a really good question. He was, I'm only speculating, but I think being a Jew in the Upper East Side, he was, I think, out of place in mm-hmm. a way. He, you know, in that period, Jews were outsiders. Mm-hmm. He was half Jewish, and they didn't even know their mother wasn't Jewish until quite a while.
Yeah, that was shocking to me.
Yeah, and his dad would want to hide his Judaism from his neighbors. Huh. And he was part of this, you know, the Stork Club and this very exciting, waspy, wealthy upper class world, and he'd go downtown and go to jazz clubs, and I don't think he really fit in there either. Mm-hmm. You know, he was trying to be hip, but he was really an uptown boy. So, but he just, you know, he got thrown out of high school, then he went to military school, and he actually did pretty well in military school, and then he gets out and he goes to college and he gets thrown out again, then goes to another school, he drops out right away. So I think being a student was challenging for him. I think he was probably bored, would be my guess. Having a hard time concentrating in class, would zone out all the time.
Yeah, it sounds like he had trouble finding his place and fitting in, because I think I'm going to mangle this probably, but I think he says a line in the movie that every time he goes downtown, he feels like a square, and every time he goes uptown, he feels like a Jew or something.
That's
or
exactly
an outsider.
It. Yeah, yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with actor, writer, director, and producer Danny Strong when we come back in just a moment. Today's episode is sponsored by Credit Associates. If you can't afford to pay off all your debt, don't let the credit card companies trick you into thinking you have to. Call Credit Associates now for free information on how to get debt-free faster than you thought possible without debt consolidation or bankruptcy. If you have $5,000 or more in credit card debt, you now have the right to let Credit Associates settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe. For free information, call 1-800-500-0351. Credit Associates depends on your success and offers a guarantee, so there's no risk. They'll even show you how much money you could save. So don't wait. Call Credit Associates at 1-800-500-0351. One more time, that's 1-800-500-0351. And now, back to the podcast. One of the transformative figures in his life was his writing professor at Columbia, I think, Whit Burnett, I think.
Whit Burnett,
Did I say that right? Who's played by Kevin Spacey in the film. What was their relationship like?
Yeah, it was a really interesting relationship. I mean, Whit Burnett is this fascinating figure, and I think a major literary figure that has been lost. He had this magazine called Story Magazine that he would publish short stories, and the number of writers he gave their first jobs to is staggering. I mean, the film only touches upon the number of writers. It's Truman Capote, Bukowski, Tennessee Williams, Cheever, Caldwell. I mean, the list goes on and on of the number of people he championed early on. And Salinger was a student in his course at Columbia. Not a good student initially, and then eventually Witt won him over and he got kind of sucked into the class and then started. And I think that's where the real transformation from the smart ass that's constantly getting kicked out of school, where he really started to focus and he really started to get passionate about writing. And then that passionate turned into ambition. And it was one of the things that drew me to the story was I knew nothing about J.D. Salinger, and I read this biography on him, and I was stunned to learn that he wasn't some, you know, crazy kook in the woods, which is how people think of him,
right.
That he was this young man of the Upper East Side that pursued a writing career with vigor and ambition. And it reminded me not only of myself, but of so many writers I know and what he goes through and the rejection, but yet sticking to it, even though you're being rejected and rejected over and over again. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, really began in Witt's class. And then Witt ended up, like so many of those people I named, he published Salinger for the first time in Story magazine. So he gave Salinger his first quote-unquote break, and I think Salinger thought, oh, I'm going to be a success now. And then – but you don't. That's not how it works, right? And then it took him months to get published again. And I don't want to get too much of what the film gets into, but when Witt read Salinger's first Holden Caulfield story, Witt was adamant that this be his first novel and that this character should be a novel.
Right, because it was originally going to be a short story or a series of short stories.
Yeah, he wrote many Holden Caulfield short stories before he started writing Catcher in the Rye. But Witt was adamant that Holden Caulfield be, quote unquote, a novel and literally kept pushing him for it. And there are letters that you can read where he's, where's my Caulfield novel? And he just was really, he really believed in it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because later in the film, you see Witt Burnett struggling with his magazine story, which, like you said, had all of these authors who had published short stories in it. And it gets to the point where he's practically begging J.D. Salinger to give him some kind of a story or something.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give too much of the movie away, but he definitely, Story magazine for its entire existence, struggled. As you can imagine,
even though they had all these great authors.
Yeah, but they weren't great when he found them. They were unknowns. I mean, he was literally giving them their first writing jobs and publishing these people for the first time or being a very early champion of them. And I love that now he's a major character played by a major movie star in a film. I think there needs to be some Witt Burnett. needs to get his due.
Yeah. Now, I didn't know that the character of Sally Hayes in Catcher was based or loosely based on Una O'Neill, the daughter of the playwright Eugene O'Neill. Somewhere in here, I saw that relationship described as a beautiful relationship with Salinger. It didn't seem that beautiful to me.
I don't think so either. I mean, you know, the fact that in the film, I'm inferring it, right? That's, I'm not definitively saying that Sally was Una. However, when he was writing these Holden Caulfield short stories, when he started it, is when he was dating Una. And it wasn't going well. I mean, Una O'Neill was debutante of the year, literally debutante of the year of 1942, which is a very exciting title. It's so funny that phrase even existed. But there was she was this sought-after beauty. Yeah. She was Eugene O'Neill's daughter. She was gorgeous. She was very well-read. She could converse. And so she was dating men in their 30s and 40s, Orson Welles, and poor young J.D. Salinger got sucked into the Una O'Neill orbit, and he was having this sort of relationship with her for during the period that he created Holden Caulfield. So as you see in the film, we infer – I say we, but it was me – infers that that this all sort of all led to the creation of the character. And what I'm trying to dramatize with that is I'm trying to show the writing process, which is how there are moments in your life that you take and it inspires you and you create fiction from the truth of your existence. And that's what I'm dramatizing in that period of time.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of drove him a little bit mad, I think, for a while there because, you know, she's standing him up. And then eventually, of course, she ends up marrying Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, and he thought it was his girlfriend.
30 years her senior
yeah,
or something like
exactly.
that?
Yeah, exactly. He thought this was his girlfriend.
Wow.
And he goes off to war and he comes. And then while he's there, while he's in training camp, he finds out that she has married the most famous movie star in the country. How crazy is that, that poor young J.D. Salinger was dumped on the front page of every newspaper in the country?
I wonder if there was a lesson that he got from that or that he got inspired by Charlie Chaplin because he was kind of famous for dating much, much, much younger women himself.
Yeah.
Or well, dating, I'm using that term loosely. They
sure.
would come live at his farm.
Yeah, and he, Charlie Chaplin married four times.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he was
but
married
Una he stayed with till
Una
he died.
Was his last wife, yeah. and they stayed together their whole lives. And supposedly after Chaplin passed away, Una was never the same. I mean, it was really the loss of her true love. And I think they had 7 or 8 children.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's an Una Chaplin who's on Game of Thrones.
Oh, is that the same?
It's
oh,
the
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's
wow.
pretty neat, huh?
Well, you know, he had a string of troubled relationships. I've heard him over the years variously described as a womanizer, a misogynist, even a sexual predator, J.D. Salinger. What were women to J.D. Salinger in your mind?
I can't answer that. I don't know what was in his heart. I know that there's a few people that have gone public, you know, Joyce Maynard very famously. I think there are plenty of relationships he had where people didn't go public, and I don't know if they had a negative experience or not. I mean, these few famous anecdotes, certainly of him dating younger women. I mean, they were, you know, 18, 19, and he was in his 50s. The film doesn't really get into this. It hints at it a little bit, but the film ends long before he gets into that age range. So it's not really the focus of the film, but I think you know, who am I to say about what his you know what his relationship towards women was? I think it is you know, with famous people, these things get talked about in such simplistic terms based on a few facts, when in fact the truth is so much more complicated, dynamic than I can just sum up on this show.
Yeah, well, maybe it's not even specific to women, but just people in general, because he constantly talks about people being a distraction, and he seems to always be trying to get away from people and block out everything else and just focus on his writing.
I think that's incredibly astute, and I think that's very much what the film gets into, which is this guy who is this charismatic young man of New York City who then goes to war. And is in World War II and has a very traumatic experience in war and is institutionalized as soon as the war is over.
With PTSD?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's the transformation of him dealing with it, and Catcher in the Rye comes from a veteran who was having classic PTSD symptoms during a period where there was no treatment for PTSD. It wasn't even labeled.
Right.
They didn't even talk about it, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a very profound story, and I think his relationship with women and men, just people in general, and the fact that this, like I said, charismatic young man in the city ends up moving to Cornish, New Hampshire, famously as a recluse, although he really wasn't a recluse. He was part of the community in Cornish.
I've heard that.
It was a very literary, very intelligentsia-type community, very artistic community.
Yeah.
And so but still this person who, you know, would disappear for week at a time just with his writing, and I think his ability to function socially was probably greatly impaired from the war. And you look at – he stopped publishing famously and spent the last 40 years of his life writing supposedly every day and never published any of this work. I think never even showed it to anyone. And I look at something like that as a writer, and I see that is a form of therapy. And someone is a very therapeutic. And one of the reasons why you don't want to show anyone the work is you don't want to interrupt the therapy or the meditation or the maybe there's a religious element to it. He became very religious, Vedanta Hinduism. And then according to his daughter's memoir, which, by the way, the son, his son refutes. So it's complicated.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so the son refutes his daughter's memoir, but in her memoir, she talks about him having a new religion each week. You know, it seemed that he would jump spiritually.
Buddhism, and once again, Hinduism, even Scientology, right?
Yeah. Seventh-day Adventist. Yeah. I just think that is a sign of someone who is consciously or subconsciously trying to heal perhaps a racing troubled mind. These are just my theories based upon observation, but it doesn't seem like it's so crazy.
Well, yeah, and it's always so hard to get into the mind of a recluse. You don't have too much to go on. He didn't give that many interviews. He actually kind of hated the press, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, he completely stopped. He gave one interview in the 70s, I think it was the 70s, when someone was illegally publishing his books. Huh. And so he called the New York Times reporter out of the blue, and she blew her mind and just started talking and telling her that, you know, and started talking about his life. And so there is this, I believe, it might be the only interview is that one.
That's interesting that that's what it took, because that kind of reminds me of another famous recluse, Howard Hughes, who only gave an interview and talked to the press when someone tried to publish a false biography on him.
That famous. But I mean, once again, I do want to state that I don't think of him as a recluse.
Right.
I think he was, like I said, not only a member of the community in Cornish, but he'd go to New York City from time to time.
Really?
He would go on vacations. He wasn't Ted Kaczynski in the shed growing a beard. I mean, he was living a life. And, you know, I think he had a very nice relationship with his son. Clearly not with his daughter, because she wrote this very damning memoir. But
yeah, and I understand that the community in Cornish was famously protective of his privacy.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
When strangers would come into town or fans, they would be very, very territorial and very protective of him.
Yeah, and sometimes people would find him at his house, and he would let them in.
Really?
Yeah, and he'd hang out with them and talk to them for a few hours.
You're kidding.
And yeah, so there's definitely stories of people hunting Salinger down and then him inviting them in, and they would hang out.
What was his ambivalence with the commercial aspects of writing and publishing? In the film, you show how he didn't want any marketing or publicity around Catcher in the Rye. It almost seems self-defeating.
And by the way, that's a first-time novelist.
Yeah.
That's not someone who's this superstar.
The nerve on this guy.
This is a first-time novelist saying, I don't want press. I don't want galleys sent out. And then he did agree to them. I think that there was a real artistic purity with him, and that he believed that the story was all that mattered, and he wanted the reader to just experience the story in its purest form. And that's very much along the lines of what the film is ultimately about, is this journey to this purest form of the artist, and what it means to be an artist. And I thought, what an amazing way to tell the story of the artist's journey, but through a writer who was traumatized in World War II and who experienced the darkest horrors of war, and then from that experience ends up creating one of the most important masterpieces of the 20th century.
Yeah, you know, on the surface of it, you do kind of feel sorry for any guy who seems to consider everyone and everything a total distraction and wants to be just left alone and not have people in his life for the most part. Yet there is something, I think, a little bit romantic about the idea of a literary genius leading this monk-like existence completely dedicated to his art, no?
You know, romantic, the notion is very romantic and sounds very artsy, but nonetheless, I mean, for me, it sounds to me like my nightmare. I mean, for me to be alone in the woods writing, I couldn't be more bored out of my mind. Yeah. But I think that just depends on the person and the personality. He is certainly not the first artist or the first writer to move away and live in a very rural environment. And,
right.
I mean, there's many examples of this. And I think that there's certainly a writer personality type that is socially awkward, doesn't deal with people very well in general, without PTSD, right? they're just not good with people, and are more comfortable, feel most comfortable when they are writing and when they are alone writing. I have a number of writer friends that are very socially awkward and you know, lovely people. And sometimes not lovely people. It just depends.
I wonder, do you think he was a happy person?
My feeling is when I read about him in the memoirs and the people who encountered him, when I read about someone, I think he was probably happiest when he was writing. and that the writing made him feel connected to something that was healing for him. You know, mm-hmm. he also ate raw foods and had this macrobiotic way of eating, you know, and he would garden and create his own foods. And all of these things, to me, with the religion and the way he was eating, they all point to someone trying to heal themselves. Mm-hmm. That's my takeaway, is an individual trying to heal himself. Mm-hmm. And I find it very very profound. I'm very moved by the story, mm-hmm. with the weirdness and all. That's just my own, you know, I keep saying that, but I don't want to come across that I'm this Salinger expert. I mean, I did write the film and I'm very knowledgeable on the subject, but at the end of the day, I don't see how someone could be an expert on someone that no one really experienced for 60 years of their lives that only their very closest family members really were around. So,
yeah. Salinger said that he would never allow Catcher in the Rye to be made into a movie. It's kind of been the holy grail of Hollywood. I think everyone from Harvey Weinstein to Spielberg has tried and failed. Going way back, tried to get it made as a movie. And he's always said no. Now that he's dead, his estate always says no.
It can never be made into a movie.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, I mean, Rebel in the Rye is probably the closest thing you'll get to a movie of Catcher in the Rye, I guess.
I believe it is. it's my feeling, and he's said this in a few interviews before he stopped doing them, that the book has autobiographical elements to it. Mm-hmm. And so to experience young J.D. Before the war has a Holden Caulfield kind of quality to it. It's pretty neat.
Yeah. Now, if the movie rights ever magically became available, would you be interested?
I would not be interested. No. I personally don't see it as a film. I think it's so much of the joy of it is just Holden's point of view and the way he sees the world and the voice of his thoughts and the way they're written. And it doesn't strike me as particularly cinematic, but I also think the expectations of adapting a book like that you could never really live up to unless you had some amazing way to do it.
Yeah. Now, another holy grail of Hollywood is actually the musical Guys and Dolls that they've been trying to get made for decades now, or remade for decades.
Sure.
And apparently you're writing that script. What's going on with that one?
Terrific question. So, I wrote the script for the remake of Guys and Dolls. And I would say of all of my scripts – I've written many scripts, many that have not been made, and of all of them, it is the one that is the most frustrating and disappointing to me that it hasn't been made yet. I think that it could be such a successful film. People really love the script.
Yeah, every song is a hit.
Every song is wonderful, and I think it could be, and with the success of La La Land, I thought, okay, this will get it done. Well, this is going to get it done, but I think this is a testament to how difficult it is to just get a movie made, and I'm still hopeful that the film will get made, but it's one of those things where I still can't believe it's just sitting on a shelf.
Yeah.
I want to scream to the heavens, people, we got a hit here. This could be so successful and so cool in the original Guys and Dolls film. I hope I don't offend anyone. It's not very good.
It
deserves to have a terrific movie made of it. It's a piece of Americana. Yeah. It's the gold standard of American musical theater. So I'm still hopeful that there will be a Guys and Dolls movie.
You know, I think that most people remember, they think that the album was the movie. There's an album that has the whole Rat Pack on it that doing all these numbers from Guys and Dolls. But the movie, you know, it's Frank Sinatra playing
Nathan Detroit.
Probably the wrong role for him.
Yeah,
he should have played Sky Masterson.
Yeah.
Brando, who can't sing, is playing Sky Masterson. It's not one of the memorable musicals of the golden age of musicals, really.
It's a strange movie, and it's shot in an almost proscenium-like way, as if they were shooting a play. And I just don't think it's not some beloved classic. And so when it was brought to me to potentially adapt, I thought, oh, I would love to do that, because I didn't feel the weight of the original movie hanging over me and this sense of – this deserves its own movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it deserves a new version.
Well, yeah, I'm amazed that they even got the rights to it because people were chasing the rights to Guys and Dolls for decades, and it was so convoluted because you had the composer's widow and then you had the Damon Runyon estate.
You understand that's exactly
well,
right.
Well, I do because I remember years ago, Stanley Tucci and I were trying to do an anthology series of the short stories of Damon Runyon, and it was crazy because the guy who controlled the rights to all the short stories, the underlying works for Guys and Dolls by Damon Runyon, was like a character out of Runyon himself. I think his name was Shelley something, and he was like this big, tough old guy from New York. I think he was a lawyer, but he would like talk about, oh, yeah, I knew Frank Costello and the guys in the outfit and, you know, Walter Winchell, that guy was a bum. And he was a piece of work.
I want someone to say that about me one day.
That guy's a bum.
Strong is a bum. No good bum.
Well, I think this film is going to do pretty well, so I don't think that you'll be hearing that anytime soon. I highly recommend that people see Rebel in the Rye. It comes out in theaters Friday, September 8th. Danny Strong, thanks for talking with me.
Hey, thank you. This was so much fun. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks again to Danny Strong for joining me on the podcast. Rebel in the Rye opens in theaters tomorrow, Friday, September 8th. And his show Empire returns for a fourth season on Fox September 27th. Follow Danny Strong on Twitter at Danny Strong. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.